and welcome to More Than a Movie, the weekly show about films and filmmaking here on Campus FM. My name's Andrew Bonello, and along with a guest I'll welcome very shortly, we're going to take a journey into the magical world of movies to explore how and why film is such a powerful reflection of real life's struggles and joys. This week, we're looking at the world through the eyes of seriously offbeat protagonists. Yes, whether they've been locked up in a dingy basement for their whole lives, or they're convinced that the end of the world is nigh, we'll discover several oddball anti-heroes who take us on decidedly unusual cinematic journeys. Coming up a little later in the show, one of our offbeat protagonists seems destined to define the world through his nostrils.
Phenomenal sense of smell was a gift that had been given to him and him alone.
A long absent father's return sets another of our oddballs off on a towering journey of self-discovery.
Hey, son. You call me Pop. Pop, Pop. All right, don't go making a big thing of it.
And if everyone around you seems blind to a mortal danger that sits in plain sight, what would you do to convince them?
You're crazy! Huh? Is that what he told you? Well, listen up!
But before we get to all of that, our guest today is Taryn Butler. She trained at Italia Conti Academy of Theatre Arts. A singer and dancer in addition to being an actress, she was a regular in plays at London's Soho Theatre, as well as touring productions in both the UK and Europe. She also acted in two plays at Malta's Spazio Creative Theatre. More recently, Taryn has obtained an honours degree in politics, philosophy and economics, and a master's in screenplay writing. In early 2020, she sold her first play to a London-based company. And she joins me in the studio today. Welcome, Taryn.
Hello, Andrew.
Great to have you here. So, Taryn, to get started, I mean, you've got such a varied panoply of experience. Can we talk about your earlier performing years? What was it that initially drove you when you were young to want to be on stage?
Oh, wow. So that's going back into another lifetime for me. Well, I went to the school of Italia Conti, so I started there when I was 9, so I was full-time, up to the age of 19. I guess it was just always a part of my life. I'd been brought up with watching musicals, I'd loved television, I loved drama, I loved singing. So it was a kind of just a follow-on, and I guess I was very lucky that my parents supported me in that.
That's great. And talking about the singing and dancing, was that something you always wanted to do within the context of sort of a narrative storytelling scenario? Or were you happy just to be singing songs, you know, doing the local dance? Or how did that sort of shape up for you?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, I left home at 18. So a lot of it is just paying the rent. And I don't mean that in a sense that you didn't love what I did, but if you're trained in everything, and most people really, I think, now have an ability to touch and do most of the disciplines, you go to where the work is to start with, and then decide where your love lies as well. And I think it's just to keep a variety of different work and keep your creative side alive.
But so, in other words, this was paying the bills for you from pretty early on, by the sound of things.
Oh, yes, I did it full time. So if I wasn't working, I'd be teaching. So teaching drama or teaching dance.
Terrific. Wow, that's great. So talking about film now, Taryn, how was your love for film born? Do you remember the moment? Did you see a film that really sort of took you to another planet and bewitched you, or...?
I think film is an ideal opportunity to forget everything that's going on in your world. And a really good film, which is obviously different for everybody, is something that you can relate to. So you have a certain empathy and understanding of where that character comes from. So if you have universal stories, you can have a very different plot, you can have a very different concept, but you can touch an audience and it just changes them in some way. So yes, I think film and TV, which I know is not quite your thing, but TV and television, episodic, concept is something that, yeah, I think it's it's the new, it's the 21st century's way of doing what Stone Age man used to do, drawing on cave walls to show their experiences and to share their experiences with everybody. Like storytellers right back in the Celtic times as well and in various other different cultures where they would show their history.
Absolutely. And so it's nice to see that theatre is alive and kicking today in many cities around the world. But obviously, per your remarks, TV and film seems to reach a much wider audience just by virtue of the sort of the technological barriers now. So it has become, in a way, the mass entertainment medium, I suppose, whereas theatre, popular as it is, probably, I don't know, is it fair to say, gets seen by far fewer people in total?
I think theatre is so valid, and it's such a beautiful form of art, and I love theatre, desperately love theatre. But I think it can become economically extremely expensive for the average person, and then it also becomes a, I can't think of the word, where only certain types of people or something. And I'm not
a little bit elitist, maybe?
Possibly elitist, but not necessarily, but financially elitist.
Right, so a bit exclusionary.
Perfect. Yeah. It can be quite exclusive. And I think when it comes to film or TV, majority of people have a smartphone. Mm. So if you've got 5 minutes from university and you just want to watch a YouTube video or even TikTok, I mean, I'm not I can't say I'm on TikTok, but for my children or for their friends or even for the TikTok is such a brilliant platform, and I know it can be used for very bad things as well, but it's such a creative,
it is indeed, yeah,
brilliance of 2 minutes, and it can tell a story, and that's all you need. So I think that's very exciting that's another new platform that's come out. But it's you've got apps on phones for just to watch short films,
right,
or you can watch Netflix in your TV, on your Mac, on your iPad, or on your phone.
Yeah, technology has sort of really democratized distribution, I guess.
Completely, which is a great thing.
So this is interesting. So you mentioned, I mentioned in the intro that you've recently sold a play. What was that play about? Can you talk about that?
Well, that was actually through the Commonwealth Writers, and they were looking for ideas to support their sustainable goals. Which is something that actually in this industry is being spoken about quite a lot, where they want stories so people can see other people actually how they're affected by climate change,
right,
or they're affected by certain dramatic things that are happening in the world right now. I put a treatment out for what I thought would make a good play, and then they asked me to write it. So it was about the ocean and all the acidification of the ocean and the dreadful, traumatic things we're oblivious to doing.
Right, we're sort of inured to them to an extent, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's great. And now, did this play get produced yet, or has that happened?
Oh, well, it's the UK, so the UK closed down a little bit.
Mm.
It was being used as for a marionette company to start with, so they were building all the puppets of my characters, which is very exciting. I haven't actually heard right now. I know they were developing the characters, they were making the characters. I haven't actually heard back from the company whether it's managed to go on yet.
Fair enough.
The Purcell rooms music rooms were writing music for it as well.
Gosh, so, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
God, brilliant. Okay, well, let's change tack just a little bit here, Taryn. So today's theme is oddball protagonists in cinema. And did you have a particular film maybe that fits that subgenre that you were keen on?
I think my first one that came to mind was the classic cult film The Big Lebowski. I can barely say it.
wait, let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. You know, that or his dudeness or duder or, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Are you employed, Mr. Lebowski?
Employed?
You like sex, Mr. Lebowski?
Is this your only ID?
You got the wrong guy. I'm the dude.
Your name's Lebowski.
So, The Big Lebowski, the Coen brothers, offbeat comedy, drama, something, I'm not quite sure. Brilliant film, very, very funny, I remember. What did you love about this film, Taryn?
Firstly, Jeff Bridges, because I love him.
What an actor.
He is. And then it's just so many amazing characters. And for me, the plot has to be good. The storyline has to be very interesting. But I think for me, characters always make it. And mm-hmm. they were just so, for them, I mean, it's a 90s film, which was actually a great time for film. And John Goodman's character that was so opposite of the dude. And then you had Danny, who again was just like part of their triangle. And I think the dynamics was just so, brilliant. You can't get bored. I mean, it's a bit like, another film that I was thinking about that. Do you really always understand what's going on? No, not really. But you didn't go into a film, especially in the 90s, to watch the Coen brothers to go, I'm going to understand every minute of this. So
in a film like that, where I completely agree, there's so much interesting characterization going on, how much of that do you think is scripted? And how much of it do you think happens as a result of the chemistry between this particular, in this case, trio of actors who have several long scenes together? I don't know the exact history of the production on set for Big Lebowski, but do you think that is a combination of script and sort of improvisation between the actors, or?
Oh, that's a brilliant question. I think that if you've got a really good script, of which the Coen brothers were very tight, so much, for instance, John Goodman's character, so much was given away in the things that he said that any actor would approach that and have a backstory if the writer or director didn't have tell the actor what to think, because the script, the dialogue is just so sharp, so witty, and says so much about the characters. Julianne Moore as well. I mean, just the moment she came on, and of course, costume and the whole environment brings so much, which is why the Coen brothers have always made those very idiosyncratic films. Because everything counts in them.
That's great. Very interesting. Thanks, Taryn. So now, in more recent years, you've moved more into the process of screenwriting and you've got quite a lot of education in this field. Would you say there's a science to screenwriting overall? Or is writing a good screenplay equal parts technique and artistic inspiration? How does it shake out? Because I'm confused on that, I'll be honest.
I think if you've got a good story, that's the most important thing. And as every writer and every self-help book for writers says, whatever your story is, just write it and then go back to what you've called the science of it, I think. Because I there are so many books, so many valid books, and that will teach you the marks that you have, the beats that have to happen, the act breaks that need to, or certain things that need to be hit before you go into the second act. And that's just the way we function as human beings, or how we are satisfied. But then after you've written it, it's always going to be changed by the director, or the actors are always, when they start either rehearsing it, if it's a play, or even if they're shooting the scene, they suddenly come up with other ideas, which will all be probably completely valid because it's the live moment and they realize what works and what doesn't work. So I think the most important thing, really, for anybody who thinks they have a story that they're desperate to tell, just get it down on paper and then shape it. Because if you can't, unless you have something, you can't shape it. And if you're on such a, If you stop yourself each time because you're thinking, well, I haven't done this, you're still going to be on the first page. You're not going to ever get to Act 5.
Right. Writing seems to be a very, very iterative process, right? Mm. You write a draft and then you sort of go away and clear your
constantly
head.
Constantly rewriting.
And come back and rewrite it. Yes, indeed. So let me ask you this. This is interesting. Now, if you had the funds, no holds barred, you could make any feature film you want or TV series. What kind of a show or film do you think you might want to make? What kind of, I mean, genre? Would you be in fantasy land? Would you be in musicals?
Gosh, that's a very broad perspective, because I'm sure there's so many different genres that you could make brilliant films in. Mm-hmm. Fantasy is always going to be a wonderful thing to make, because you have no barriers at all. Your plot and your story is as great as your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose mainly I would want something that is touching and reaches an audience, is successful, is critically acclaimed, as well as definitely liked by people. I wouldn't want to just make something that was critically acclaimed. I'd want something that was popular. But I guess, I mean, that's the same as absolutely everybody doing any form of art.
You'd want to make something that was...
works.
That really works. Yeah. I mean, wouldn't we all? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we've mentioned you also write material for the television show format, not just feature films. Can you talk a bit about the main differences structurally? Obviously, we've got length and the way things divide up, but how's the process of writing for TV different from writing, say, a feature film?
Comedy is slightly different to drama. If you've got a drama serial, you also have to map out... I mean, you've got series and serials, so you've got three different things there ready for television. So comedy would roughly be 20 minutes to half an hour, where you'd need to understand your characters, so your characters would have to say and respond to things in a certain way, so their characters were very defined. But you would probably have a story every week or every show if you're streaming it. With something like drama, you can really delve into A story, B story, C stories, D stories. So you've got a whole world that you're beginning to develop, because the world is actually paramount with where your characters are moving and living in.
So in a drama, the story plays out over multiple episodes.
Yes,
I'd say it's sort of a longer arc.
Yes, so if you're, each episode would have to have certain pointers in it, but then if you had a six episode, the number three, or even if you had six or seven, number three would have to be your middle, and number one and number six would have to be a mirror of each other. So it's all divided into tiny little sections, exactly the same as a scene, the start of it and the end of it. You'd have to have the arc, and then each of those arcs would have to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then the acts would also have to mirror each other. So, but if you had a series rather than a serial, then again you have the drama, so you're getting to know each character, so again you probably have three stories, A story, B story, or C story, but then you would also have a cop show, or something that's investigating. You'd have a different crime every week.
Right, a driver.
Yeah.
So talking about training in this field, are there any books on screenwriting that you'd particularly sort of recommend? Because there are so many, aren't there? There are the classics, the starting going back to Aristotle's Poetics, and then Sid Field, and now you've got Blake Snyder and Robert McKee. And which one should our listeners read?
Oh, everything and anything, because you're going to agree with some stuff, and then you're going to disagree with others.
Mm.
I think it was actually Robert McKee, if I'm right in saying, who is brilliant. He basically said, along with quite a few other brilliant, brilliant writers, have said, there's no point in getting rid of the formula to write your own stuff until you know the formula.
Yes.
So there's, just read any of those books. Into the Woods, and I can't think of the author.
John York, yes.
John York,
the BBC.
Who is, I'd say that was probably one of the best, but there really are so many. John York obviously is a British writer.
Mm-hmm.
Robert McKee is an American writer. I would say there are slight differences,
right,
definitely, in the two ways they approach stuff. But all goes back to Aristotle.
Yes, absolutely.
It all goes back to the Greeks.
Yeah, I loved John York's book, Into the Woods, and I think he actually, if I'm not mistaken, spoke about that sort of mirroring that
fractions,
you mentioned.
Yeah,
that's right. That it happens at fractal levels at various sort of scales, that you get mirrors of each other happening at different times. It's fascinating, really. Well, look, okay, let's talk about one of your other sort of choice movies in the oddball protagonist subgenre, Taryn. Do you have one?
Yes, a film that I really can say I didn't completely understand, but it was brilliant, the world that they'd created. It was Birdman.
We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy? He used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Hold the mask off!
You
do Birdman 4!
So, Alejandro Iñárritu's Birdman, Taryn, yes. I didn't really get this film either, to be honest. I wasn't a huge fan, although I can recognise certainly the talent and the quality of the production. What did you make of it?
I don't even know if I really enjoyed it, to be honest. I love Michael Keaton, again, since Beetlejuice, another wacky film, could have also been an off-ball protagonist.
Yes, indeed.
I think what I really enjoyed about it, it was the deconstruction of the actor's ego and watching Michael Keaton just going through this really weird mental state. Mm. And the fact it was all filmed like it was all on one take was... Well, I wouldn't say experimental, but it was actually, as a viewer, I found that you never felt comfortable watching it. I never felt comfortable watching the film.
Indeed.
Edward Norton, again, God, anything he's in is just brilliant. Emma Stone, again, anything she's in,
I just love her.
Yeah. So I found that the concept of Birdman, the story was really, really very interesting. And again, the protagonist, I think you couldn't really ease into the film because you weren't sure if you really liked him, but at the same time you kind of felt sorry for him, but at the same time you didn't really understand him, so you have all these conflicting feelings so the empathy is not really there, which is one of those things when you need to connect to a film, but
a bit of a tragic, enigmatic protagonist, really, wasn't
it? It was just very wacky and
thank you terrific. Interesting. So stepping back a bit, Taryn, now something I sometimes get confused about in the writing process. What exactly is the difference between story and plot from your perspective?
A very good question. I think story is everyone's story is going to be different. So, because all your influences, your background, your interests, the desire to write something so passionately, that's your story. And you have to take that story, and in order to be able to write that down, you need a structure, and the structure basically is the plot. So you've got the plot of certain things that have to happen, and those plot points will be valid in your story. So the plot points will be different for everybody, but it is like having a structure where you have your inciting incident. So you'd get to know all the cast in the first like 5 minutes, and then you have your inciting incident where somebody wants something and they're not going to get it, or something just disastrous happens and then they have to go out and achieve something that they didn't think they would have to do. And then you would normally have something where they're refusing to do it, and eventually they are convinced that they do have to do it. And by the sort of the midpoint, everything is grand, and then it just goes worse and worse where everything is lost. Mm. I mean, these are, again, very formulaic, but what makes it important is you're hitting those beats, but those actual structural points are different for everybody because the stories are different. So someone's inciting incident could be anybody from not having their car start to having their mother kidnapped. So completely different, but each could be an inciting incident. Mm-hmm. So the story would make it individual, rather the plot points would be your structure to hang your story on.
So if I'm understanding, the plot is kind of the scaffolding of your overall piece, and the story is kind of the details, the little itty-bitty sort of texture, if you will, that, as you say, is specific to particular people.
Yeah, the decoration right. Around it. So you've got your flat pack.
Got it.
House.
Got right, it. Right.
And then you're decorating.
Then you're your decorating way. It. I see. You're painting the walls, as it were.
Yes.
Great. Thank you for that answer. Okay, well, we're almost out of time, Taryn. One quick last question. If people want to find resources online, podcasts, perhaps websites that give good advice about screenwriting, have you got a couple that you'd recommend, maybe?
Oh, there's so many. And I advise everybody to choose the ones that they feel comfortable with. Scriptapalooza is a great site. They do one of the best competitions as well, but they've got a mine full of resources. Raindance, which is UK and LA, I know Raindance quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Their website is full of fantastic resources. Stage 32, it's not just, none of these sites are just where you have to buy stuff. They've just got a mine of information. They've got lots of blogs. They've got lots of very interesting people wanting to talk and wanting to describe the processes. Bang to Write is also excellent, Lizzie Fry. Sundance Collaboration. I mean, there are so many. BBC Writers Room, excellent. To get lots of scripts. Read scripts is the most important.
Right. Read lots of screenplays, apparently, is the way to go.
Definitely.
Fantastic. Well, this was very interesting, Taryn. Thank you very much for coming on the show, and we wish you the very best of luck with your ongoing screenwriting work, and we hope that we'll be seeing lots more stuff that's written by you, hopefully on the screen and perhaps on the stage very soon. Thanks for coming on the show, Taryn. Now then, what about movies with offbeat protagonists that were shot here in Malta? Well, there's an obvious answer that immediately springs to mind, and that is, of course, Popeye the Sailor Man. Yes, he from Robert Altman's curious 1980 film.
Oh, Popeye!
He's Popeye the Sailor Man!
Oh, my hero!
He's Popeye the Sailor Man! He's strong to the fish, but he eats his fish. He's Popeye the Sailor Man.
Oh, I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
And Robin Williams' portrayal of Popeye here is about as offbeat as it gets, to be sure. But we already discussed the film Popeye back in episode 6 of the first season of our show. So, are there other oddball movies shot here in Malta? Well, I dug a little deeper and found the story of Mickey King, who writes trashy genre novels with no ambition whatsoever of becoming a legitimate writer. But when a new client is murdered under mysterious circumstances, he takes inspiration from the detectives of his own noir fiction and starts to investigate. From 1972, this is, well, I'll let the movie speak for itself.
The word I am about to tell you will soon be on everybody's lips. It is pulp. Big mouth killing the whole spiel. Ladies and gentlemen, the word is pulp. P for laughs, U for excitement, L for action, P for fantastic. Pulp also contains the following magical ingredients.
Well, okay, perhaps he's not a particularly offbeat protagonist here, but Michael Caine is in delectably deadpan mode here as our Scribner-turned-detective. Director Mike Hodges assembled a stellar supporting cast in the guise of Mickey Rooney and Lionel Stander, of course both big names from mid-20th century cinema.
Is he still alive?
That's the way it is, Bright Eyes.
I'm getting some very bad vibrations.
But don't stand so close to me!
Family.
We've all passed a lot of water since then.
He shoots very well for public relations, man.
Shut up and enjoy yourself.
Well, Michael Caine is still acting today, including roles in many of Christopher Nolan's films over the last decade or so. But Pulp is a reminder of just how long he's been around, with a mainstream film career spanning well over 50 years. Quite incredible. And the grim backstory here hardly sets up a serious movie. There seem to be delightfully comic antics afoot, and shot in locales all over Malta at that. So if you're a fan of the cool Cockney Mr. Caine, here sporting an awesome pair of thick-rimmed spectacles, then you might want to dig up a copy of 1972's Pulp.
Feel free to tell all your enemies about it.
Sod off, Nanny. Sod off!
Well, it's now time to venture beyond Malta to discover some truly offbeat protagonists. And what a lineup we have for you today. First off, Bubby spends 30 years trapped in a dingy room by his own mother. When he finally escapes, deranged and naive in equal measure, his adventure into the modern world begins. From 1993, this is the Australian black comedy Bad Boy Bubby.
At first, he did seem to spend a lot of time alone. Mum looked after him. Although sometimes she called him her bad boy, Bubby. And there was always Cat to play with.
Well, what can I say about this movie? Talk about a weird protagonist. I promise you, you've never seen a movie quite like this one. It is incredibly strange. The first act sees Bubby under house arrest by a very nasty matriarch. Now, I won't lie, the language used throughout this film is very strong indeed, and there's more than one difficult and disturbing scene. The opening, in particular, features moments of incest that many will find hard to stomach. But I challenge you to forge ahead, for these scenes are certainly not gratuitous in nature. And indeed, your rewards for persevering will be great.
Then one day...
Hey, son, you can call me Pop.
Pop came back, and everything changed.
All right, don't go making a big thing of it.
Bad boy Bubby went on a voyage of discovery. And the world he confronted was funny.
Well, as you heard, the first act ends with Bubby predictably shrugging off his parental shackles, with considerable verve, I might add, and emerging into the real world for the first time. This is a quite staggering piece of screen acting by Nicholas Hoult, who uses stillness and his piercing gaze to quite stunning effect. This, quite apart from his repeated verbal outbursts. At first contact with other humans, his character is dazed and confused, to say the least. His initial utterances quite literally consist of parroting back phrases that people say to him. And as we'll see, that continues at moments throughout this story.
Honest.
That is fat.
And hypocritical.
God doesn't like fat.
And totally unlike any you've ever seen before.
God, you've got great tits. Great big whoppers of things.
Bad boy, Bubby. Bad boy. The whole thing is odd in the extreme, and yet I challenge you to find me a more sincere character study than this. Writer-director Rolf de Heer actually hails from the Netherlands, and this work is notable in a few respects as a filmmaking endeavour. De Heer made use of no less than 32 different cinematographers for the various scenes in this film, and those shifts in tone and composition are quite brilliantly combined here. The sound technique was also innovative for its time, using a binaural recording rig taped to the actor's skull for a very different auditory perspective. And well, this all combines with the truly wackadoodle storyline to create one of the most surreal and, simultaneously, most heartfelt movies I've seen in donkey's years. I kid you not. Among his newfound friends, Bubby actually joins a band and develops his own quite unique performance style, which again largely consists of animal noises and parroted repetitions of various outbursts and epithets that people have yelled at Bubby in prior encounters.
Ah, 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 ah.
Get him! Get him! Get him!
Hey, son. You can call me Pop. I'm your Pop.
Hey, Pop!
Hello, son.
Hello, Pop!
Yeah, that'll do. Don't go making a big thing of it. What's the matter with you, son? You got a bit of a mental condition or something? Leave Bubby alone. Leave Bubby alone.
It's ludicrous, madcap stuff, right? Well, yes. Yes, it is. But it's quite extraordinary as well, how well all this works. I mean, it's laugh-out-loud funny in places, to be sure. And there are moments late in the film, when Bubby spends time in a home for people with serious physical disabilities, that arguably touches on the limits of what's appropriate to render on film. But again, I'd argue that this is an absolutely pioneering piece of character cinema. It could even be called a masterpiece on its own terms. Once more, I'll conclude this segment with that caveat. There's very strong language and difficult content here, to be sure. That said, though, for one of the most captivating offbeat protagonists you're ever likely to see on the big screen, you really ought to cast off your shackles for Bad Boy Bubby.
We proudly present an extraordinary film by Rolf Dahir, starring Nicholas Hoult as Bad Boy Bubby, and delightfully supported by Claire Bonito, Ralph Cottrell, and Carmel Johnson. Bad Boy Bubby. All he needs is love.
Well, let's change the pace a little bit now with a piece of music from the soundtrack of one of the forthcoming movies in our show. Before discussing that film, let's go on to our next offbeat protagonist for today. An introverted man born with dwarfism leaves the city when his only friend passes away. Inheriting an old train station depot, he displaces to rural New Jersey, seeking a life of solitude. But there he finds something else entirely. This is The Station Agent from 2003.
You ever been out to this part of New Jersey?
No.
I mean, there's nothing out there. Nothing.
Finn is about to start a new life.
Where do you live?
Depot.
What grade are you in?
I'm finished with school.
Olivia is leaving her old life behind.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
How you doing?
And Joe.
Do you sell coffee?
Where are you from?
Hoboken.
I live in Manhattan, dude.
Just doesn't have a life.
I've been here for 6 weeks. It's driving me crazy.
Well, this is a lovely little feel-good character study, if ever there was one. Many of you will recognize Peter Dinklage of Game of Thrones fame, here taking on an early role as our unusual leading man. And his performance really anchors this movie, imbuing his character as he does with such a subtle sense of loneliness. It's that of a man who really just wants to be left alone. His new environs have other plans for him, though, when he's nearly run over by a charmingly clumsy lady in her SUV.
Can I? Oh, God. Oh, God.
I'm okay. I'm okay.
Can I give you a ride somewhere?
No.
You sure?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm...
Well, here, Patricia Clarkson steps up to the plate in a really beguiling role. You might recognize her for a memorable part she played in Frank Darabont's 1999 crime fantasy, The Green Mile, with Tom Hanks. She also played the lead in a recent procedural detective genre movie titled Out of Blue, which I'd say is also worth a look. But here in The Station Agent, Clarkson's character, whilst ostensibly providing comic relief and potential love interest, proves to be a much more subtle and layered interlocutor. But this is actually an ensemble piece, albeit a humble one. So there's a superb buddy movie foil here in the guise of Bobby Cannavale. You may recognize him from his supporting role in Woody Allen's 2013 drama Blue Jasmine. And here in The Station Agent, Cannavale plays Joe, a hapless young chap manning his sick father's snack van just across the way from the train depot. And he's the last kind of buddy you'd expect to find yourself liking, really.
Come on, man. You gotta tell me what happened. You're not going anywhere today, are you?
We'd like to return this. Do you know where she lives?
Oh, you had freezer out. But that's just me. Very lucky, bro. She's a pretty woman. She's got that sexy, smart older woman thing going. It's nice.
Do you know where she lives?
Oh, yeah. She's on Green Pond Road. It's like 3 miles down the road on the right. Hey, listen. If you guys do something later, can I join you?
We're not gonna do something.
No, I know. But if you do, can I join you?
We're not gonna do something later.
Okay, but... You do?
And there we have it. That's the basic setup. Three characters just hanging out. This film is so deceptively simple, yet it works so effortlessly. A masterclass in pacing and editing from director Tom McCarthy and his editor Tom McCardle. Each scene could almost be a vignette all of its own. So superb are the characterizations and performances here. Yet they each form part of a strong, albeit apparently unremarkable, narrative. There's also a lovely little supporting turn from Michelle Williams, who had a very young role in 1995's sci-fi actioner, Species. Well, here in The Station Agent, Williams plays a charmingly befuddled librarian.
I'm so sorry. Oh, God, I didn't know anybody was in here. Can I help you?
Check this book out.
Okay. Do you have a library card?
No.
Okay, well, do you live in town?
Yes.
Okay, well, I need a proof of address, so if you could bring in a piece of mail, then I can give you...
All told, then, this is one of those films that seems to be over before it's even really begun. That's how compelling it is in film-viewing terms. And our offbeat protagonist here, played by Dinklage, might almost seem a little unlikable at first, so avoidant of social contact as he seems to be. But this story has a heart of gold, and it's one which I really recommend.
You know, it's It's really funny how different people see me and treat me. Because I'm actually just a very simple boring person.
Lovely drama here. And let's just have a little musical interlude from the soundtrack of The Station Agent now. And this gives you a really nice idea, I think, of the tonality you can expect from this film. The music is composed by Stephen Trask. We switch pace now to a film made at an altogether more epic scale.
In 18th century France, Jean-Baptiste Grenouille was born with a talent that made him unique among mankind.
Stones, warm stones, water, frog.
His phenomenal sense of smell was a gift that had been given to him, and him alone.
And yes, we played an excerpt of music from this film's soundtrack just a little earlier in the show. From 2006, we have Perfume, the story of a murderer. Talk about an offbeat protagonist. Here, our leading man, Grenouille, is so obsessed with capturing the perfect scent of a woman that he's willing to take very extreme steps in order to do so.
Intoxicating power of the girl's smell made it clear to him that he must learn how to preserve scent, so that never again would he lose such sublime beauty.
Plays our unusual anti-hero here, and he's supported by many well-known actors. Dustin Hoffman is the perfumer extraordinaire and mentor to our would-be scent snarer. In an intriguing little subplot, the aromatic student gives his master something of a schooling in his very own trade. And this story element actually feels faintly reminiscent of Pixar's 2007 film, Ratatouille. Well, Perfume, the Story of a Murderer, was adapted from a Patrick Susskind novel of the same name, which I also enjoyed reading. There's a complex plot at work here, with great support from Rachel Hurd-Wood. Even the late Alan Rickman lends a hand.
Each perfume contains three chords, necessitating 12 notes in all. One can only create a truly original perfume by adding an extra note.
Last night I dreamt you were dead. Murdered, like all the other girls. Whatever his insane scheme, it will surely be incomplete without you.
Tom Tykwer, who also made Run Lola Run and Cloud Atlas, directs the movie, which is staged at a quite massive scale. This is a glorious production at every level, with astounding art direction and sumptuous production design, incorporating both elaborate set construction and computer-generated special effects. So whilst this is, yes, in essence, a story of murder, as the title doth suggesteth, it's so artfully done, and it's just such a beautifully rich period piece, well, those grisly proceedings are instead birthed with a genuinely lyrical undertone. Take, for example, this scene on the streets of Paris, when Grenouille first catches the scent of a young lady selling plums. And note the musical backdrop here in particular, and the magical sense of mysticism it creates. That's just one memorable moment from a film that is literally bursting with them. Wishaw is captivating in a challenging role that has to skirt the fine line between simultaneously invoking our repulsion and our empathy.
The soul of beings is their scent.
Overall, then, tis a glorious olden day yarn about an offbeat protagonist. The soundtrack of the film does a tremendous job substituting smell, which we obviously can't perceive in a movie theatre, with sound, which we can. Take this wonderful, and indeed heartbreaking, choral example from one of the film's almost operatic closing moments. This is 2006's Perfume, The Story of a Murderer. Finally then, for today, we stay in very serious offbeat protagonist territory. A tormented man is plagued by a series of apocalyptic visions. Unsure how to handle the situation, the young husband and father builds a storm shelter, whilst questioning whether he should be protecting his family from the coming tempest or from himself.
What's the matter, you curse?
It sounds like thunder.
What sounds like thunder?
I've been having these dreams. They always start with a kind of storm.
Missed you at church this morning, Curtis.
Thinking about cleaning up that storm shelter out back.
I love you, Bill.
I know. I'm sorry. I had to run in here.
I'm going to build out the tornado shelter in my backyard. I could use some help.
The hell you want to do that for?
This needs to be done.
This is 2011's Take Shelter, starring Michael Shannon. Well, goodness me, if we don't have a tortured leading man here. Shannon's is a solid body of work in both TV and film already. And here, director Jeff Nichols asks him to pull out all the stops in a performance that is both oblique and unsettling. It must take tremendous maturity as a performer to suggest the kind of inner turmoil required of this character by facial expressions alone. Well, Shannon is more than up to the task, leaving us genuinely unsure as audience whether his visions are to be trusted or whether we're actually just witnessing a rapidly fragmenting mind.
You didn't say one word about this to me.
I didn't want you worrying about it.
Samantha!
Are you out of your mind?
I'm doing this for us. I know you don't understand.
You want to waste money on a stupid tornado shelter?
Your mother was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia in her 30s.
I thought people were watching me and listening to me.
David's been telling me how strange Curtis has been acting lately.
Shannon gets very strong support here from Jessica Chastain, doing brilliant work as the ever-loving and supportive wife, who's placed under increasingly untenable strain as our protagonist digs ever deeper. Tova Stewart is charming as the couple's deaf daughter, and we also have a nice supporting role from Shay Wigan. Now, if you've tuned into earlier editions of More Than a Movie here on Campus FM, you might remember that Wigan also had a strong mention in episode 2 of the first season of our show. That was for the Man vs. Beast thriller Splinter from 2008. Well, as the buddy character here in Take Shelter, Wigan's character and our harangued leading man eventually come to blows in the church hall, and that in front of the entire town.
You think I'm crazy? Huh? Is that what he told you? Well, listen up! There is a storm coming! Like nothing you have ever seen! And not a one of you! Is prepared for it.
An immensely powerful scene. Shannon is truly searing in this film. But the real delight about Nichols' piece is its constant flirtation with different film genres. There are elements of both science fiction and horror hinted at in the film, and that with more than a little aplomb. Mystery also abounds, yet principally, this remains at heart a drama about a truly tormented soul who's doing his very best to keep his head above water, as it were.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
The movie ends with a superb final scene, which I shan't go into here for fear of spoilers, but suffice it to say that this should more than whet the appetite of the most ardent of you genre movie fans out there. The sorry story of this deeply troubled offbeat protagonist comes highly recommended, then, in 2011's Take Shelter. So, what did you think of the movie selection in today's show? For that, or any other feedback, suggestions and questions, please email us at morethanamovieqs@gmail.com. That's morethanamovieqs, all one word, @gmail.com. This More Than a Movie episode was written and presented by me, Andrew Bonello. A big thank you to our guest, Taryn Butler, for joining us today, and also, of course, to our sound designer, Redent Abdillah. The intro music was Creepy Comedy, and the outro is Inspiring Teaser, both by Raphael Crux at filmmusic.io. The clips are licensed under creativecommons.org version 4. Thank you so much for listening, and I do hope you'll join us again next week for another episode of More Than a Movie.